This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and today's guest is a fellow broadcaster, celebrating an impressive more than 50 years in the business. Now, whether you're local to Dothan, Alabama, or lurking on his Facebook page, you can enjoy a weekly dose of blues power on 1450 AM or 102.1 FM WDIG. I've made it part of my weekly habit to check into his live Facebook chatter. He's a fun guy, and I'm betting he has a ton of great stories to tell. So with that, let's introduce Gil Anthony. Man, it's an honor to have you on Time Signatures. How are you, sir?
I am fine, thank you. Thank you. And I love your backdrop. That looks like my house, in fact. I feel like I've been transformed and I'm looking at myself here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun putting it together, and I love changing things up here and there.
There's a lot of memories right there, isn't there?
Oh, there certainly are. There certainly are. Gil, let's dig in here and get rolling, man. We got a lot to talk about. I'd like you to talk about your earliest memories of music.
Earliest memories of music. Well, first of all, I was born in North Dakota, if you can believe that. Dickinson, okay. North Dakota. I was always into music. My mother worked at a hotel and down in Dickinson, North Dakota. And downstairs, the accountant for the hotel was also a jukebox vendor. So when he got took the records out of the jukebox, he'd put them on these shelves and sell them like 2 for a quarter. And I would go down there and start buying records. And that's when I started buying records. I was probably 9, 10, 11 years old. And I was probably one of the few kids, much less white kids in North Dakota, who grew up and I had every Ray Charles record. He was my first love, and it always has been. So that's really wow. where it started. It just grew and grew until about 1994, I got rid of my collection. I was a serious collector. I collected Excello, Sun, Specialty. I collected everything, being in radio.
Oh, man.
California radio. I had over 15,000 albums and 20,000 45s that I got rid of. So, but I've always loved it. Always have loved that and sports. And what a combination to have a love for sports and a love for music and end up in radio. So there was no other choice.
Now, Gil, do you kick yourself for getting rid of all that vinyl, or was it time to move on?
It was sort of time to move on, because I had some in storage and that. And I thought, okay, I have not listened. What happened back in the day when I was in radio in California, you know, that was mm-hmm. the heyday of records. I'd go down to Sunset Strip. I worked in Santa Maria, Lompoc, Santa Barbara area. And I'd go down to the Sunset Strip and go visit the record companies, and they'd just always ask me how many copies you want of everything. So I'd always get one for me, one for the radio station, and one for anybody else at the radio station wow. wanted one. So 60% of my stuff was still sealed. It'd never been played because I played it at the radio station. And I've been fortunate, you know, back in the day to meet a lot of great people, even just in California. But I moved out here in Alabama in 1979, and I worked country radio. I was watching that the Opry 100 the other night on television, and I was telling my wife how fortunate. I was telling her a Ronnie Millsap story. I worked with Ronnie Millsap. I was telling her a Charlie Pride story. I was telling her an Alabama story. And it just, you know, we may not have much money in radio, but sure have a hell of a lot of memories, great memories.
Yes, indeed. I didn't work anywhere near as long as you did, but I've got a few of my own stories that I someday might share, but it's all about you tonight. Now, I have to ask you, Gil, was working in radio something that you always saw yourself doing when you were a young man? And I'm asking because I have a few vivid memories of me doing some DJ-type stuff when I was about 9 years old. I'd rip and read newspapers. I'd talk about the weather. And then I'd introduce songs on my record player using a walkie-talkie to transmit to the world. Any of that sound familiar to you?
Oh, it did. And when I was in high school, we used to have a high school program on radio like once a week to read the scores and events and that coming up. And I was in a speech, it was part of the speech class, and I volunteered to do that right away. And then when I was in the Air Force, I knew what I wanted to do, go to college. I was going to college in the Air Force, and I also wanted to get into sports. And I did a lot of play-by-play in my previous life also. So I'd be out where I was working. I'd be reading the newspaper out loud. I'd be reading sports. I'd be reading the box scores, just anything. And I'd be doing it out loud and always practicing. When I was going to college, I'd go watch them practice basketball, and I'd do the play-by-play for their practices if they had scrimmage, just doing that to myself. So it's been something that, I always did that. And I always read it out loud, just be cognizant of what you were reading, how you were reading it. Just, so it made sense to not only you, but to somebody who was listening and nobody was listening.
Now, I also had a radio experience in high school. We actually had a high school radio station at Bay City Central, WCHW, 93 FM, and or 91.3 FM. That's what it was. And got a little bit of experience doing all of that when I was a kid. Now, I want to talk about how you got your start. When you first got your initial jump in the business, talk about how that presented itself and how long did that first stint last?
Well, believe it or not, I was going to school in San Francisco, and I got a job. I said, okay, I want to be in radio. Back then, I don't even know it exists. Radio and Records, does it even exist anymore? The trade magazine?
I don't know.
I put a thing out there, and I got a job back in North Dakota.
Oh my
and
gosh.
It was KDAK in North Dakota, in Carrington, North Dakota, which is sort of in the middle of North Dakota. And I went there, was newly married. My wife had, she had one more year of college left. And we went to North Dakota in October. Well, as soon as the snow melted, we were back in Santa Barbara in April. I was there that long. And that was it was back then when we had block programming. You had 2 hours of rock music, 2 hours of country, 2 hours of farm news. You had news every half hour. You just had block programming. And that I really learned a lot there, because I've always loved all kinds of music. So you got to experience that feel of a small hometown. And then when I came back to California, luckily I landed up in Santa Barbara, and that was a cool situation to be in. And that's where it really got rolling. And I've worked at a lot of stations, did a lot of I also did play-by-play. I loved sports. So I did a lot of college, high school play-by-play in California, here in Alabama. In fact, I'll never forget that. I was thinking about that this afternoon while I was thinking about talking to you. Very first football game I did, we were at Lompoc, which is Lompoc, California, north of Santa Barbara. It's a town of about 50, 60,000 back then. And we were playing a team from Los Angeles area. And they had a lot of Samoan and Hawaiian names on the team. And I got the roster like 2 minutes before kickoff. I didn't even have time to prepare. And I had no idea how to pronounce any of these names. And the next day in the newspaper, I just got ripped by the columnist. Get somebody who knows something about the game, who knows how to pronounce these names. And oh my gosh. So I'm a firm believer from then on, I was always prepared doing games, whatever sport. I've covered a lot of sports. I would always be prepared. I'm always set up at least an hour and a half before a game, because I want to be prepared. And that I learned the hard way. You learn people's names. You just come in fully prepared. And really that's where it started, was in California. I worked up and down the coast. And like I say, I moved out here in Alabama in 1979. My wife had finished school, and she was working for Bank of America, and I was working at various radio stations. And one of the ladies she worked with was in the Air Force. Her husband was in the Air Force. They lived in Mobile. Well, they told us, come on south to visit them. And to us, going south was going to South LA, So we came to Mobile. We loved the area. We said, hey, let's go. It's an affordable place to live. So I put an ad in the trade magazine. A gentleman bought a station in Dothan, Alabama, which is a town of about 70,000 now. And he moved me from California. He moved another gentleman from Illinois, another gentleman from Kentucky to work at a country station. That's where it really started. And that's where I really got to work with a lot of great country artists. I was just telling you the other night, I watched that Opry 100, And I worked with so many of those people that were on there, or had, I was telling my wife about stories about them. Not that she really knew who they, any of those people were, but I've been blessed to work with country. And then I got into blues in 1995. And from there on out, it's been a little bit of everything, in fact.
Now, I would like to talk about the blues for a minute, Gil.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have not always worked in the blues like so many others. You did a lot of dial and genre hopping along the way. Is that correct?
Yeah, I programmed a lot of different formats. In fact, I tell people the only format I hadn't formatted was punk Easter music. You know, that's about it. That's the only format. But I formatted one of the first, if you can believe it or not, in this area, there was not an urban, what we called back then in the 80s, was not an urban station. So what happened was I was working at the country station, and the boss bought a station that was dark, was not on the air. He bought that about 30 miles away. And we put that on the air. We were easy listening back then, you know, the Commodores, Ann Murray, that type of thing.
Sure.
And then at night, I hired this gentleman called Dr. J, and he would play R&B, soul, jazz. He mixed it all up, starting at 6 o'clock at midnight. Well, after about a week, it was about 2 weeks, I told the boss, we're changing formats. He said, what? I said, we're going all urban. He said, why? He said, when Dr. J comes on the air at 6 o'clock, the phone does not stop ringing for 6 hours. I said, that's it. You know, they were trying to listen to a station out of Albany. So we went all urban. But I've been connected with all formats, country, a lot of oldies formats. I started doing blues at one of the radio stations back in 1995, just an hour program. And what I would do is just tape it and be played on Saturday morning. And that's latter part of 95 and 96, because I remember one of my first interviews in 96 when I was really rolling along was Luther Allison. That was my very first interview. Day after he won the WC Handy Awards at 9 o'clock in the morning, he was gracious enough to get up. And I just remember that interview very explicitly. You know, it started from there. And I've been blessed with the people I've met, interviewed. And like I say, I've been going to Memphis twice a year since about 1996. I go to the Handy, what is now the Blues Music Awards, and the IBCs every year.
And, very cool.
Yeah, I did it at various stations. I did Blues Power at various stations as I sort of worked it in to either work a weekend show or something. And then in 97, a gentleman wanted me to come over and program an oldie station, so I did. And it was US 100, WXUS. And I said, how about let me do a 5-hour show on Monday nights, blues? He said, let's try 1 or 2 hours. Do 2 hours, and we'll see how it goes. After the first show, he said, would you like to do those 5 hours? And so I've been doing 5 hours on Monday night since 1997.
Wow.
And about 10, 15 years ago, I added Sunday nights where I do 4 hours. So I do 9 hours in the two nights.
Yeah.
And I chose Mondays because Monday, a lot of the musicians were at home. They were, you know, off the road. Listeners weren't doing anything. Nobody's doing anything. Plus, I wasn't interrupted by a sports show. I wasn't interrupted by basketball, baseball, whatever. And I was such a believer in continuity. People expect you to be there. I've worked, whether it's Christmas night or whatever it is, people rely on you being there. You don't want to give them an excuse not to be there. So always been there, you know. So really, I've been blessed to see, you know, with the people I'm at. And now I just buy my own time on WDIG, you know, Sunday and Monday nights. And they know I'm always there. So, you know, that's something that I've loved doing. I've cherished it. I'm retired. And how stupid am I? I buy the time to work. You know, I pay them so I can work.
So you actually buy time to be on the station.
Yes.
They don't pay you to be there.
No, they don't pay me that. That way I figure nobody can tell me what to play, when to play it, how to play it. It's my
program.
You
go. That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, Gil, I have to tell you, it's a cool new world out there seeing you broadcasting your show live while running a Facebook Live feed, interacting with your fans and friends. And it's something that keeps me coming back because as somebody who worked in broadcasting for several years myself, we never had that back then. But this seems to be the current state of business for the radio side that really does appeal to me. Talk about that for a minute. What's that like on a regular basis?
Well, sometimes I just don't feel like doing it. There are, sometimes you're not in the mood, just like radio. You're not in the mood. But, I was always a morning person in radio, and people would say, "How can you sound so chipper and happy at 6 o'clock in the morning?" I said, "Do you really want to listen to me if I'm moaning and groaning about something?" I said,
That's
"You don't
fair.
listen for that." But what happened with the Facebook Live part several years ago, I can't remember how long, Charlie Boyer of Florida Jazz Blues, a music magazine that's on the internet. I always put on Facebook, "Okay, tonight on Blues Power, I'll be featuring so and so tonight. Be sure listening." Well, I put in there, "I'm sorry, I can't. We're not on the internet tonight. Our server went out of business up in Ohio. They went out of business over the weekend." So I said, "I'm sorry, I can't. I won't be on the internet." Well, and Charlie says, "Well, just take your telephone and put it on Facebook Live and put it close to a monitor." So I did that, and that's history. I couldn't stop doing it. I mean, people will message
Wow.
me, "Gil, I'm going to be late tonight." And I do the 2 hours. The first 2 hours I simulcast, and then after 8 o'clock I just go to straight radio. And also another thing, the wearing of the sport coats. And in Memphis, I'm known for wearing a lot. I change twice a day to the loud, outlandish sport coats. They expect that. But I wore a sport coat. For some reason, I wore a sport coat a couple Mondays in a row. Well, one night I decided to just wear a t-shirt. And then I got a message, "Well, Gil wasn't on Facebook tonight. He must have taken the night off. Some guy wearing a t-shirt was there." So, and it's become a great way for And it's become a great way for listeners to interact with the artists, because if you've seen it, you see a lot of the artists drop by. Janet McManus drops by, TC, Tony Coleman, all these friends of mine drop by, and I'll go, "Oh, there's Sugar Ray Rayford. Let's play a song by him." And then someone in the audience, "I like that, Sugar." And they start interacting. And that
Yeah.
helps build a relationship between the listeners, because sometimes that's the only interaction the listener gets with the artist, is just by what they hear. And vice versa, all of a sudden, Sugar, Tony Coleman, Tony Braunagle, whoever, gets a brand new fan. So
Yeah.
it's two-way street for everybody. And then people start joking. We have a Flamingo No Pants Monday. Don't ask me how that started, but that started
That's
with
my
everybody
next,
saying,
that is
"You're
my
all the
very
fun."
next question, Gil. That's my
Yes.
very next question. Talk about it, man. Go ahead. You're on a roll.
I have no idea how that started, if there was alcohol involved or what, but all of a sudden we're doing Flamingo No Pants Monday, and it started up by, "Okay, oh, there's so and so, no pants, don't stand up, please. Oh, you stand up, you can stand up, you're all right." But people have been sending me flamingo things all over the world. I got flamingo shirts from artists. I've gotten Vanessa Collier sent me a flamingo puzzle she saw in an
Oh my
airport. I've just got
gosh.
all these different flamingo things. Tony Garaci sent me a Garaci sent me a flamingo neon light. So I've got all kinds of flamingo things going on, and it's just another thing people have fun with. I figure, doing my show, if I bring a smile to your face or do something ludicrous or whatever it might be, I've done my job. Because there are some people, that, hey, that's what they need. They need that uplift. They say, "God, this is what I needed, to get with my blues family." And I always say, just like going to Memphis and just like being on Facebook Live, I said, "This is part of the blues family." And I always compare it to a family reunion. The only
Sure.
difference is we like each other, and
Right.
you can't choose your relatives. You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your relatives. But
Yep.
that's really basically how it started. It just goes on and on, and people love it. I mean, I don't know how many pairs of flamingo sunglasses I've had through the years. Everybody's sending me some, but I appreciate it. If they took the time out to send it to me, I appreciate it. I love every one of them. I really do.
Well, I think that that's a lot of the reason why I've made it a part of my day on Sunday and Monday. I try to slip in either one or both of those
Right.
days, just even if I'm only there for a few minutes. I mean, last time I was in there was Monday, and of course you told me not to stand up because it was No Pants Monday. And I got to talk to Sean Murphy, who I just thankful to you was able to interview. Had a wonderful interview with her, and that's coming up. I mean, I've had a lot of fun just popping in there because you remind me a lot of myself. I like to just have a good time And it seems like that's what you want to do when you're on the air, is just have a good time, you know?
Yeah, I've been blessed. I'd like to say I've been in radio for 55 years, and I've been fortunate this phase of my life. I've never had a job in my life, because it's not a job if you love it. And I love it. Right. I mean, say a Blues Power, I probably have missed up until I've started. Now, during the BMAs, I'll tape a program, but I probably missed maybe three programs, maybe five programs total, even excused absences, signed Epstein's mother. But I have probably missed five programs in 20-some years. And one of them was due to open heart surgery.
You had a reason.
Senior night for my son at his college basketball game. And really, that's only the only two unexcused absences I've had.
That's crazy. But that speaks very highly of the work ethic and the fact that you really enjoy what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
Gil, I need to turn the page for a minute here. Yeah. I have to imagine that you've had some great interviews along the way through the years, man. Any good stories to share?
Whew, where do you want to start?
Wherever you man. You're driving.
Let's talk about Sean Murphy. I remember the first time I met Sean Murphy. I had been playing her music. And this is quite a few years ago. This is probably 12, 13 years ago. We've become dear friends. She comes here. I've stayed at her house. Our wardrobes look a lot alike, you know. But I remember the first time I met Sean, I was walking down Beale, and I was walking by this place where the IBCs were going on, and a gentleman was having a cigarette outside. I said, "Is that Sean Murphy inside?" I sort of recognized her. She was sitting up against the wall by the glass. And he said, "Yeah." And so I went and introduced myself. I was intimidated by her because I knew her history and everything. And sure. I just went up to her and I just introduced myself. We started talking. We became instant friends. And we have been really close friends. I've got a Sean Murphy wall. If you ever come down to South Alabama, I'll show you with a whole lot of things. But there are so many, many people I've been blessed with. I became close friends with Ruth Brown. Ruth Brown, the last 15 years of her life, we talked probably once a week. We laughed, cried, everything together. I mean, I've got a Ruth Brown wall. I've got enough for two walls for her. But she was just such a dear, dear friend. We just talked about everything. And I heard those stories. Jim Gaines, I don't know if you know Jim Gaines, the producer who just passed away. Jim produced, you know, him and I were such close. I got to tell you a story about him. Jim and I have October 2nd. We have celebrated our birthdays. We call each other. I'd call him most of the time. We'd sing happy birthday to each other. Well, his wife, Sandy Carroll, who's a great songwriter, probably most remembered for Just As I Am by Luther Allison. But her birthday and my son's birthday fall on Halloween. So we've got October covered. But one of those things with Jim, one of the greatest storytellers, just look up his track record. The new releases, he produced the last one by Ronnie Baker Brooks, of course, Johnny Rawls. He worked with Carlos Santana for 30 years, Stevie Ray Vaughan's In-Step album, Huey Lewis in the News. The list goes on and on. Anyway, it's one of those things that you're always glad you did. This last May, they have been bugging me to come by their house. They live up northwest of Muscle Shoals. So on my way to Memphis, I went and stayed with them. And Jim and I just sat up and talked. And excuse me, I get a little emotional talking about Jim Gaines. But we just sort of reflected on the kind of life both of us have had. And
yes, sir.
Jim passed away in October. And it was one of those instances, you're glad you went to see somebody because you always say, well, I'll see him next time.
Yeah.
You don't know if there's going to be a next time for you or for me. So do it. And I am so glad I did, because when I went to Memphis after visiting Jim, I was talking to Tony Bronigle, and Tony, the producer and drummer, and he said, well, I got to swing by him. I have a little bit of time when I come back, so I'll swing by his house. He never did. And I remember him messaging me when Jim passed away. And he said, you know, he wished he'd have done what he said he was going to do, go by and see him, because you never know when you lose someone like that, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I get emotional with you.
No. That's what this is all about, man. We like to get the real stories, and I appreciate you sharing those. Now, Gil, on a brighter note here, looks like you were the recipient of the Keeping the Blues Alive Award in 1996. Compliments of the Blues Foundation.
2013.
Oh, did I misread it?
2013 is when I got it. Don't make me that. 1996 is when I started. Damn.
Okay. Well, like, I want to hear. I want to hear the story.
Sean Murphy and I were talking one time on the phone. And I said, Sean, you know, between us, we have over 100 years in the business. And she goes, damn, I got to go take a nap. I'm tired. Yeah, 2013, the Keeping the Blues Alive.
Well, talk about that. What was that like, man? Did you see it coming? Did you get any kind of a heads up?
It was no. Well, yeah, you did. I think I was. It was presented in January, but they tell you about October. And it was humbling. It really was. Because, like I always say, it wasn't a popularity contest. It's not members or somebody voting on it. Someone submits your name, the whole body of work. They look at what you have done for blues and keeping the blues alive. And they just look at everything you've done. And so, like I say, it's very humbling because it's not a popularity contest. It's something that's given. And you really feel humbled receiving it. And it's a special, you know, and it's, like I say, it's not an award that's given every year to someone in radio now. Now, if there's someone deserving, they get it. If there isn't, they don't get it. So,
okay.
Yeah, it sits up on my mantle up there, and it's a very nice thing.
Very nice, very nice. Now, speaking of Memphis, I have to imagine, since you go down there so regularly, have you done some MC work while you're in town?
Oh, I always do. Yeah. Again, yeah, I go there. I do a lot of it during the IBCs because Gina Hughes, who has a Galaxy agency in Nashville, she always has showcases at BB King. So I volunteer to go over there because it's just fun to be with everybody. Like I say, you know, we've been in the business long enough. We've heard the music. The music is great. But what we love, what I love, and what all the other entertainers love, we love the camaraderie. We love to sit in the hotel lobby till 3-4 in the morning and talk. We love to just mix with each other because I say we're family. We only get to see each other a couple times a year where someone isn't unloading or, you know, loading up or whatever, they're going on stage. So this is a perfect relaxing time. And yeah, you get to meet a lot of new people during the IBCs, especially when I work. I try and help Gina out because she does so many good things for the Blues Foundation, for the blues community. And I figure that's my little part that I can do because I love it. And I love to see these young people be part of the IBCs. As far as May is concerned, during that, you know, if they need me, I do it. I was fortunate enough, Teeny Tucker, who's a dear friend of mine, and I were presenters at the BMAs a couple of years ago, and that was always a great experience because, you know, it's just like giving a gift to a member of your family. That's what it is, you know. And so, yeah, I love it, and it's a great time. In fact, we're counting down the days now. I think we're down to 50 days before I leave for my trip usually for the BMAs consists of leaving, going to Clarksdale on Monday. Have you ever been to Clarksdale?
I have not.
Oh, you need to go. Go.
I'm working on it.
The first place you have to go is Bluesberry Cafe to see Art and Carol Corvero. Hang out there because Watermelon Slim will set you on your table. You'll have D. Carp come in. Heather Cross plays there. Stan Street. And it's just family atmosphere. And I hang out and stay at the Shack Up Inn, which I've done for years. I'll stay there. And then Tuesday morning, head to Memphis, hang out in the lobby, waiting for everybody to check in and that type of thing. And a couple of times we've gone down to Beale on Tuesday, and it's full of tourists. And we say, let's go back to the lobby. There's more happening in the lobby at the Sheraton than there is on Beale. And there is. Everybody starts checking in. And like I say, it's just the family reunion starts on Tuesday night when everybody starts coming in. And we just sort of hang out, tell stories, and nobody wants to go to bed because they're all afraid they might miss a story. I remember one year after the BMAs, we're sitting there talking. They closed the bar, so we moved a few feet over in the lobby and keep talking. All of a sudden, in the foyer of the hotel, a jam session breaks out with Ronnie Earl on guitar, and Anika Chambers was in there singing, and Paul DeLaurier was playing guitar, and Diane Blue is singing, and just all these. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Kirk Fletcher came by, and this is 3:30 in the morning, you know, so it's always an eventful time and so many memories. I mean, so, you know, a lot of times when I leave Memphis on Saturday, I usually leave on Saturday mornings, I won't play any music or anything. I'll just sort of drive for about the first hour and just think of all the memories I just made that particular week. You know, hey, I hung out with so-and-so, went to eat with so-and-so, did this, did, and it's always fun. And one of the other things that we always do, my wife is famous for her sweet potato pies. So I take eight sweet potato pies to Memphis for the IBCs and eight for the BMAs. And people don't care if I show up. They want to know where her sweet potato pies are, because a lot of Northerners have not tasted sweet potato pie, and especially my friends in Canada. And we serve it. We have a community breakfast on Thursdays. Everybody's invited that's listening. On Thursday of the BMAs, we have a community breakfast over at the arcade. We usually have 20 to 30 people, and they'll have breakfast. I bring sweet potato pie that's served in the restaurant with Cool Whip, and then we'll also serve it in the lobby of the Sheraton, whatever's left over. So we always have a great day. Those are just little things that we do as part of the family.
I got to tell you a quick story here. I'm a pumpkin pie fan, okay? Went over to my local Meijer store here one time. This is three, 4 years ago. Grabbed me a pumpkin pie, and boy, my mouth was watering. It was just before Thanksgiving, and I wanted to have that first slice, you know. Took a bite. It was sweet potato pie.
Yeah.
And? It looked, well, I wasn't expecting sweet potato pie, doggone it. I was expecting pumpkin
pie.
Like
it now, though?
It was, you know, all right. It was all right.
I can't tell you the last time I had pumpkin pie. There's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
A whole different ball game, you know. And I've had a lot of people, like I say, that have never had sweet potato pie until they came to Memphis. And now they're sweet potato pie lovers. There's meetings for people like us.
Yeah. Now, Gil, from what I'm reading, you're also doing a lot of work with Blues in the Schools on occasion as well.
Yeah, first of all, myself and Dr. Jenny Brooks, we started the Wiregrass Blues Festival. And what that was there's a lot of talent that came from this area. The Candymen, who backed up Roy Orbison, they were from Dothan, Alabama. Buddy Bowie, who wrote Spooky, Stormy, Traces, Every Day With You, all the Dennis Yost classics, four things.
Yeah.
Atlanta Rhythm Section, that was Buddy's group. Buddy was from Dothan. Mickey Thomas, Fooled Around and Fell in Love, Starship guy. He's from just across the line. We're about 10 miles from the Georgia line. A lot of this talent comes from this area. Like I told you, Paul Hornsby, who is the producer for Capricorn Records, comes from New Brockton. Eddie Kirkland, who played with John Lee Hooker back in the 40s and 50s. Anyway, we had all this talent. We wanted to recognize them. So we started up the Wiregrass Blues Festival, and we started doing that and recognizing the artists. Mike McCarty, who's a good friend of mine, and take a look at some of Mike's work. Mike did the artwork for over 300 album covers. He did all the Atlanta Rhythm Section. He did Bertie Higgins. He did Starbuck. He did Isaac Hayes, William Bell, just all these famous works of art. You know, growing up, how many times you pick up an album because of the artwork? Well, about 300 of those were done by Mike McCarty. In fact, he just did a Big Mama thing for me for the Big Mama Thornton Museum. But anyway, we did that for about 3 years, and it started getting too big for it. Was a two-horse show, more or less. So we handed over a newly formed Wiregrass Blues Society. So they got that. We became a nonprofit organization. We started doing Blues in Schools. And so far, Blues in Schools, we probably have done. I've had Mac Arnold come. Teeny Tucker, what a dear friend. She drove all the way from Columbus, Ohio, did a Blues in Schools for me, got in her bus and went home.
Holy
Crystal
cow.
Shimonda has been here. A lot of my musical friends come down, do a Blues in Schools. And we just want to open the doors to the Wiregrass area, what we call the Wiregrass area. Let these people know what a rich musical heritage they came from. And just to let them know that blues is the roots of all music. You know, I always say, I compare it to a tree trunk. You have the trunk, which is blues, and then you have all these branches. Over here, you have hip-hop. Over here, you have country. Over here, you have jazz. But guess what? It all comes to the trunk and the roots, which is blues. So that's what we try and do. And we try to do it to musically. When we found the best way we do it, we don't do many high schools, because a lot of times the kids, unfortunately, are too cool. They're too cool to show that they really like it, you know. Now, after it's over, they'll come talk to the musicians and talk to them about playing. But we have found we get the best reaction from, like, about middle school kids, who are really, really interested in it all. Yeah, and like I say, we've done probably over 14,000 kids as far as the blues and schools are concerned. And we've also done a couple of programs where we did we'd take harmonicas, and one of our members was a good harmonica player, and we'd go to like the Boys and Girls Club, we'd go to places that have after school programs, give them a harmonica, and just let them have fun with it and just expose them to music, because to me there are only two kinds of music, good and bad. I don't care what format it is. I mean, there's terrible blues music, there's good music, you know, in every genre. So that's really what we try and do. And again, like I say, if we hit one person, then we feel like we, and I feel like we've done our job. We've had a lot of kids come up to the artist and say, hey, I sing, but somebody tells me I can't. And they just want a little advice, a little reassurance and this type of thing. So this is really what we're looking for. And I think most of the time we've done our job. We've done pretty good.
Very cool. All right, man. You knew this was coming.
Yeah.
What was your most embarrassing blooper in the course of your broadcasting career?
Ooh, I didn't know that was coming. Well, there's a couple.
Okay.
There's a couple. All right. Not really embarrassing. One, you just don't know what to do. One, believe it or not, was in sports. I'll tell you one about sports. I was doing a high school football game, and we were going to have a parachutist right here at Fort Rucker. This is we're close to Fort Rucker, which trains all the helicopter pilots for the armed forces.
Okay.
And we had a skydiver, something was going to drop the football in right down in center field, you know, in the middle of the football field. And he comes in his parachute, and all of a sudden the wind got him. And he flew over the stadium and landed in somebody's backyard. And for some reason, I got this visual of Martha and John sitting in the backyard. He's having a beer, and damn, Martha, look at what just landed here. You know, I mean, the visual got me, and I started laughing. I never break up. I can keep a pretty straight face and keep it going. But it just tore me up. I started laughing. We had to go to a commercial break. I came back, and again, I got that visual of this guy landing in someone's backyard where this guy's having a beer, and all of a sudden somebody pops up, you know. That, I lost it forever. Then another time was in music. I was interviewing this German artist, and I can't remember his name, but they can use expletives in radio in Germany that we don't use over here.
Okay.
Yes, and he gave me the F-bomb about four times on the air live.
Oh, no.
And I did, and he didn't, we went to a commercial break. I said, what are you doing? He said, what did I do? I said, you just used the word, the F word. He goes, oh, well, we can do that. Oh, I've got one. Yeah, here's one for, do you know who Paul Osher was? Paul was the first, Paul was a good friend of mine. And for the people that don't know, Paul was the first white guy to play in Muddy Waters' band. He was like 17 years old. Wow. A lot of times during my show, if I was playing a song by like Paul Osher, I'd call him up. I had their home phone. I'd call him, hey, Paul, we're playing a song. You're one of your songs. You want to talk for a few minutes, get off this song. He said, sure. Well, first time I tried to call him, he didn't answer. He was living in New York at the time. And the second time I called a couple minutes later, he finally answered. He said, I didn't answer. I thought you were a damn bill collector. And so I said, okay. Well, I said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm just messing around on my guitar here. I said, hey, you want to talk? We're playing one of your songs. He said, sure, I'll talk. And the song was over. And I said, well, we're called New York. We've got Paul Osher on the line. Paul, how you doing? What you doing? He said, oh, I'm just effing around. And I go, Paul, we're live. And I go, okay, 30% of the audience really didn't hear it. Another 30% thought they heard it, but didn't know. And then the other 40% really didn't care, you know? So, but yeah, he put me in that. There really haven't been that many embarrassing moments. I mean, a lot of enlightening type moments, but you know.
And, yeah, bloopers. Bloopers are always fun, you know?
Oh yeah, they were. But Paul did me up. He just said it, you know, I didn't even realize what he said. I go, oh, Paul, and you got to know Paul. And you know, that was a nice one for Paul. That was a good story.
Very cool. Well, Gil, what's next for you, man? I mean, Obviously, you're not going to be expanding your show or anything like that. Do you have any fun ideas or any fun plans down the road? And most importantly,
everything is fun. Well, I don't know if I've been following. I just opened up a big Mama Thornton museum.
Okay.
In Ayrton, the town that she was born in, is about 30 miles from our house here. I've always been a big faithful fan of Big Mama Thornton. I've been working on making people aware that people from this, I always say you're least famous in your hometown, in your home area. And this is basically true. And I have been throwing this out there that Big Mama was from this area for 30 years. And a lot of people, even in Ayrton, didn't believe me. So that was really a journey I was on. And I just accomplished it. In 2020, we got Big Mama, of course, elected in the Blues Hall of Fame in 1984, right before her passing. She passed away in December, and I think she was put in the Hall of Fame in May of 84. Well, finally in 2020, she was put in the Alabama Music Hall of Fame. And then in Paul Hornsby, the producer friend of mine, called me up and said, Gil, call those people up there and straighten them out. They have her from Montgomery, Alabama. Tell her she's from Ayrton. So I called them up. And I told him she was from Ayrton, Alabama, a little town here 30 miles away, and that some of her family was still around. And so I gave them the contact. They got a hold of her family members, and they brought them up to Montgomery, or brought them up to Muscle Shoals for the induction, and they treated them just like royalty, which was great. I loved it. And then this last year, Big Mama was put in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I talked to the people up there, and they didn't have, they were putting her in, they like to put exhibits of the people that are coming into the Hall of Fame. They didn't have anything on them. So I have all her albums, and I have posters, memorabilia, and all that, and they wanted to loan some. So I took it up there, and they said, no, you can mail it. I said, no, I'd rather go up there. So it was a 15-hour drive for me, and I like the face-to-face contact. I can make a relationship with them, build them up. And I had more plans in store. So when I went up there, donated it to them and lent them the albums. I'll get the albums back in a couple of years. But I told them about the members, and we took Ben and his brother up there. They went up, and we went up to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, and that was just a super thing. To give you a good example, when we were up there, and I've been telling her family how big Mama was as far as an influence in music world in general, then they wouldn't believe it. Well, we were at a VIP party the Friday night before the induction. And anywhere we went, I'd always tell them, well, we're with the Big Mama Thornton contingent. And they go, it's about time. It's about time she was put in, all these people. And then in the middle of the night, I'll never forget, we were upstairs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Ben Key, one of the relatives, was sitting there shaking his head. I said, what's the matter, Ben? He said, I can't believe everybody knows who she is. And, he just couldn't get the fact that she was worldly known, not just in music, but everybody, every age group. And these people that were telling us that were in their 20s, and they knew who Big Mama Thornton was. So one of my big things was I've been a collector. This is a museum in itself. My whole house looks like your background. Anyway, I had a lot of posters and newspaper articles about Big Mama from the 60s and 70s and all this stuff. So what we did, with the help of her family, we got the town of Ayrton, bought a building there that had been a bus station / phone office. And when the bus would come in, Big Mama Thornton would sit out there as a young 8, 9, 10-year-old, play the harmonica for the people that came in. So we turned that into a museum. And I put all my posters, memorabilia, records. I have a lot of photos, probably 50, 60 photos of her, 8x10s. I have probably another 8, 10 posters, concert posters, she played in so many. And they couldn't get over the fact. We had the opening. We ordered a big marker, one of the historical markers. We ordered that. We got that put up. And about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had the unveiling of the marker. And I had friends come over and play some music there. Little Jimmy Reed, Debbie Bond, and a few people came over and played. We had the unveiling. And I was just over there just a couple hours ago. Friends of mine came down from Illinois, and they wanted to we took them to the museum to see all that. But that's been one of my things, because Big Mama, I don't know if you know, is buried in an indigent grave in Inglewood, California, with two other people in the same grave. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what they did in the 80s, indigent graves. I mean, and we wanted to move her remains back to her hometown, but you have to get permission from the other two estates. You have to rebury them. So there's a lot of red tape involved, and I'm not a red
Wow.
tape type person. I was talking to Mike Stoller, who was the co-writer of Hound Dog, and Mike and I were talking, and he suggested just putting up a memorial in the cemetery or something. So after the museum is now open, so my next thing is to raise some money to put a Big Mama monument, say that three times anyway, in the cemetery at the church in her hometown. And that's probably one of my projects. I got one of the projects achieved,
Wow.
the Big Mama Thornton thing, and that was a big thing in my life as far as I was concerned, you know.
Indeed.
So I got that accomplished. I'm happy. And you know what's happy about the whole thing? I love to watch the family and just to see their reaction, just like when they were at the Alabama Music Hall of Fame, when they were at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, to just watch them. Then I feel like I've done my job to see how much they enjoy this. They weren't aware of it. In fact, they when they have spoken about it, they always say Gil brought Big Mama back to life. She wasn't she was dead as far as our family was concerned, but he brought her back to life. And that's probably one of the greatest compliments you could get,
Sure.
you know.
I'll tell you what, if you ever get a chance to talk to Walter Trout, ask him about his Big Mama Thornton's story.
Oh, I have been fortunate. I'm glad you told me that because I love to talk. I just talked to Laguerre, a friend of mine who's a friend of Bruce Katz's, and
Okay.
he played bass for Big Mama. But all these people that play for her, Doug McLeod had some hilarious Big Mama stories, and he's such a great storyteller. He was telling me stories in the lobby of the Sheraton last year. And then let me tell you a Big Mama story about Anthony
Sure.
Taurasi, the great piano player from the Boston area. He was telling me that when he was going to the Berklee School of Music, he was about 19 years old. Him and a couple of other guys, they would back up local artists that came into town because back then that's how they traveled. They have pickup bands, and that's who would back them up. Well, they were going to back up Big Mama Thornton, and Anthony said he heard all these horror stories of Big Mama. He said, oh, they got there and they were just sweating bullets. He's on piano playing. They start out first song. She stops it, kicks everybody off the stage, and she said, you piano player, stay here, pointing to Anthony. He goes, oh my God. She got behind the drums. She played drums, played harmonica, sang Anthony on piano all night long, never called the band back. It was just him and her
Wow.
all night long. And she goes, I like you, piano picker.
She
But,
apparently when Walter first met her, he was under direct orders that you will not come up here and just go crazy. She says, all I want you to do is go up there and play that guitar like B.B. King. And he said she went up and introduced him. She says, this is my guitar player, Walter, and he's going to play this guitar like B.B. King. And I guess he must have done it to her satisfaction because he played with her for quite a while. So, but
that,
Gil,
you know, yeah.
while we're talking about the museum, let's have you put the website out there if you have that or some information. And also, what about you? You have a website, Facebook page? Tell people where they can find you too.
I just have the Facebook page. I don't have a website. We don't have a website for the museum yet. We're establishing when we're going to be open and this type of thing already. Various individual groups. I talked to one of the gentlemen who's the head of the music department here at a local college. He wants to take his whole music class over there. We'll be glad to do that. But we're going to have contact information up pretty soon as far as
Okay.
that's concerned. They can friend me on Gil Anthony Facebook, you know. I'm so lonesome, I'll take anybody as a friend. So, you
He took
know, now,
me. He took me.
yeah. No, but you know, if people love the blues, they love music, you know, and don't take life too seriously, you know, we want them to come and join us because like I say, it is an experience for people who aren't associated with people, you know. I mean, and you know that in dealing with artists, they're just like you and I. You know, they put their pants on one leg at a time, and they're working people just like we are.
Except
And
for No Pants Monday.
that's right, except for No Pants Monday. You're right. But, you know, it's just been, you know, just working blues. Like I say, you never know who you're going to come in contact with. Just like when we were at the we were at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. In my house, I've got drum heads. I take drum heads to Memphis. You might try this. And I got drum heads, and I take them to Memphis, and I probably have about close to 60 drum heads with 20 to 30 autographs on each one.
Wow.
Everyone from B.B. King to Willie to whoever. But I had taken a drum head to the VIP party in Cleveland, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we're sitting there having a drink, and a guy sitting there with a sort of a sports jacket, he was a leather coat on. He comes up to me and said, "You a drummer?" I said, "No." I told him what I did. He said, "Oh, I'm Vinny Lopez, the drummer for E Street Band."
Wow.
And we started talking, and he told me how Bruce Springsteen got with him and Clarence Clemons, you know, because they needed a singer, so they got Bruce Springsteen to sing for their band, you know. You never know who you're going to run into, you know. And
indeed.
So it's been, like I say, you talk about interviews and that. I've had the fortune. Unfortunately, a lot of my people that I've had on the show are no longer with me. And,
yeah.
You know, people like Eddie Clearwater, there are a lot of the old artists I found out that just love to be appreciated. And I've developed good relationships with them. I'll call them on their birthday or just to say hello for no reason at all. Because, you know, like Dorothy Moore, who did Misty Blue, her and I are close friends. Our birthdays, we were born in the same year. Our birthdays are about 8-9 days apart. But I'll call her on her birthday or whatever, or on Thanksgiving, right around then, and just keep that relationship going. Can I move for just one second? I've got to show you something. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay, just keep talking. I'll be right back.
This is what a live interview is, folks. You just sit here and you roll with the punches. And he's coming back. Here he comes.
I don't know if you can you see this?
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
This is Muddy Waters. A listener did this in 2003 for me. Well,
wow.
A friend of mine got it from a friend of his. It's a wood burning of Muddy Waters. Okay, and what I have done, this is autographed by only people that played in Muddy's band.
Wow.
You got Johnny Winter, Hubert Sumlin, Bob Margolin, Paul Osher, James Cotton, Pine Top Perkins, Bob Stroger, Eddie Shaw, Willie Big Eyes Smith, Hubert Sumlin, Carrie Bell. And this is just one of my proud pieces. I love this piece.
You haven't had Primer sign that yet?
Who?
John Primer?
Did he play with Muddy's band?
He played in Muddy's band.
Was he in Muddy's band? I don't know. If he was, I know he was in Magic Slim's band. That's where I first saw him.
I believe he was with Muddy before. He was one of the last band leaders. Played guitar.
I'm glad you told me that. I'll have
yeah.
The only one that I'm the only other person that's missing that's still with us is Jerry Portnoy. As you can see, Johnny Winter, Paul Osher, James Scott, they're all passed away. In fact, Big Bill Morganfield signed it, Daddy, Big Bill Morganfield.
Wow.
But we were talking about that at lunch today. Pine Top Perkins, Bob Stroger. Yeah, Bob Stroger is still with us. Most of those people have passed away, unfortunately.
I don't know if you can see just to the left of the sign here, the little square.
Yeah.
That's Pine Top Perkins CD signed by him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's one of my prize pieces.
Like I say, I have so much of this kind of stuff. A friend of mine gave me piano keys, all the keys from a piano. So I have them signed by blues piano players.
Very cool.
And I've reconstructed it in a shadow box. So it's like Henry Gray, Pine Top Perkins, Victor Wainwright, whoever plays piano, all these pianos. So that's just, you know, it's a lot of fun. You know, my wife, you know, she doesn't know what she's going to do with all that stuff.
Well, Gil Anthony, it has been a pleasure having you on Time Signatures today, sir. I wish you much continued success, and I hope to run into you soon on Beale Street. As a matter of fact, I'm planning on coming down to the IBC in January, so I will make
it
a point to look for you, okay?
Very good. I was going, let me tell you about it. I missed the IBC. This is your first time in 16 years. What happened was a couple of days before I was supposed to leave, I woke up one morning and I was seeing double in my left eye. And I got worried about it. So I went to the doctor and they checked me out just to make sure it wasn't an aneurysm or a mini stroke or an eye stroke. And it was a muscle in my eye had torn or something and I was seeing double.
And
if I was driving down the road, if someone pulled up to my left, it felt like they were coming in right at me, turning into my lane. And I was supposed to go to Memphis. And they, you know, we had bad weather. It snowed then.
Yes.
Snow and driving with one eye are not a good combination. Now, I could drive with one eye. I have done that with one eye and good weather, but I didn't want to take the chance. But the first time in 16 years I missed it. What made it really bad is I was supposed to MC a celebration of life for Jim Gaines, where Huey Lewis was there, Johnny Rawls was there, everybody from Memphis was there paying tribute to Jim Gaines, and I was supposed to MC it. And I had to call Sandy and told her I wasn't going to make it. And let me tell you, that was one of the hardest calls I ever had to make, because I told her I felt like I left Jim down. But yeah, and all they said, all it will take is time, and time healed itself. So I'm going to be back. I'm, like I say, 50 days, I'll be in Memphis. And hopefully you could come to the VMAs and come sit at the big people's table. We have a lot of fun.
I'd love to do that sometime.
Yeah, we're usually the most rowdy group. The gentleman who buys our table, and then we pay him. He always bought the table. The last 2 years, we were smack dab in front of the podium.
Wow.
I mean, front row. And I don't know if you know who Kenny Blue's boss Wayne is. Am I cutting you short?
No, you're fine. Anyway, go.
Kenny Blue's boss Wayne, I was up at the Blues Blast Awards up in Peoria a couple of years ago. And Kenny and I have a habit of buying sport coats. I probably have 110, 112 sport coats. Kenny's the same way. Kenny's the sharpest dressed man in blues. Anyway, we found out about this store in Peoria. A friend of mine who lives in Bloomington said, I got to take you to a store. So the first day I went in there, and I was wearing one of my loud shirts, louder, you know, red shoes. And the guy goes, I like that. Where'd you get that? I said, I bought that at E&J Warehouse in Montgomery, Alabama. He said, that's my nephew. I said, what? He said, my nephew has that store. I said, well, I don't live there. I live in Dothan. That, I worked for that guy.
Wow. That's
where I buy my clothes, in Dothan, Alabama. All three of these people are related. Peoria, Montgomery, and Dothan, Alabama. They're related.
Wow.
Anyway, Kenny, Blues Boss Wayne, we had breakfast and told Kenny about the store. We all went in there. And Kenny and I bought the same purple sport coat. I mean, really nice coat. So in May at the BMAs, we were in the lobby. I said, Kenny, did you bring your coat? He said, yeah. I said, okay, let's wear them tonight. We both wore the same coat. And people thought it was just an accident that it happened. And we must have had 7,500 people take pictures of us together. Anyway, Kenny won the Pine Top Perkins Piano Player Award.
So
we were posing for it like we're fighting each other over the trophy. People just had a lot of fun with it. But we had the same coat on. And Kenny is the sharpest dressed man. He's just a super, super guy. But you have to, you can borrow one of my coats. They used to have a contest in Memphis. How many coats did Gil bring to the BMAs? And usually for the 4 days I'm there, I'll bring around 15 coats, you know, because I have to change twice a day. That's
sure.
Another thing people have fun with. I let them have fun. Well, one of my roommates 1 year, we had started. Well, she told me it's time to go. So we got to go.
Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the show. Now, before we wrap up here, I just want to remind you that it takes about 5,000 streams to raise the equivalent of about a $20 CD. Now, I couldn't believe it either, but I've made it my policy to buy music from the artist first, and then and only then I will stream on the various platforms. I mean, if you want live music to be out there, we owe it to them to spend some of our hard-earned cash supporting their music and their merch. Trust me, they will thank you every single time. And thank you for your consideration, folks. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Gil Anthony, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, my friends.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in-
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.